Chapter 7. As you travel northward, your eye, accustomed to the south or east, does not notice much difference until you are beyond Birmingham. In Coventry you might as well be in Finsbury Park, and the Bull Ring in Birmingham is not unlike Norwich Market, and between all the towns of the Midlands there stretches a villa civilization indistinguishable from that of the south. It is only when you get a little further north, to the pottery towns and beyond, that you begin to encounter the real ugliness of industrialism, an ugliness so frightful and so arresting that you are obliged, as it were, to come to terms with it. A slag heap is at best a hideous thing, because it is so planless and functionless. It is something just dumped on the earth, like the emptying of a giant's dustbin. On the outskirts of the mining towns there are frightful landscapes where your horizon is ringed completely round by jagged grey mountains. And underfoot is mud and ashes, and overhead the steel cables where tubs of dirt travel slowly across miles of country. Often the slag heaps are on fire, and at night you can see the red rivulets of fire winding this way and that, and also the slow-moving blue flames of sulfur, which always seem on the point of expiring and always spring out again. Even when a slag heap sinks, as it does ultimately, only an evil brown grass grows on it, and it retains its hummocky surface. One in the slums of Wigan, used as a playground, looks like a choppy sea suddenly frozen. The flock mattress, it is called locally. Even centuries hence, when the plow drives over the places where coal was once mined, the sights of ancient slag heaps will still be distinguishable from an aeroplane. I remember a winter afternoon in the dreadful environs of Wigan. All round was the lunar landscape of slag heaps, and to the north, through the passes, as it were, between the mountains of slag, you could see the factory chimneys sending out their plumes of smoke. The canal path was a mixture of cinders and frozen mud, crisscrossed by the imprints of innumerable clogs, and all round, as far as the slag heaps in the distance, stretched the flashes, pools of stagnant water that has seeped into the hollows caused by the subsidence of ancient pits. It was horribly cold. The flashes were covered with ice the color of raw umber, the bargemen were muffled to the eyes in sacks, the locked gates wore beards of ice. It seemed a world from which vegetation had been banished. Nothing existed except smoke, shale, ice, mud, ashes, and foul water. But even Wigan is beautiful compared with Sheffield. Sheffield, I suppose, could justly claim to be called the ugliest town in the Old World. Its inhabitants, who want it to be preeminent in everything, very likely do make that claim for it. It has a population of 500,000 and it contains fewer decent buildings than the average East Anglian village of 500. And the stench. If at rare moments you stop smelling sulfur, it is because you have begun smelling gas. Even the shallow river that runs through the town is usually bright yellow with some chemical or other. Once I halted in the street and counted the factory chimneys I could see. There were 33 of them, but there would have been far more if the air had not been obscured by smoke. One scene especially lingers in my mind. A frightful patch of waste ground, somehow, up there, a patch of waste ground attains a squalor that would be impossible even in London, trampled bare of grass and littered with newspapers and old saucepans. To the right, an isolated row of gaunt four-roomed houses, dark red, blackened by smoke. To the left, an interminable vista of factory chimneys, chimney beyond chimney, fading away into a dim blackish haze. Behind me, a railway embankment made of the slag from furnaces. In front, across the patch of waste ground, a cubical building of red and yellow brick, with the sign, Thomas Grocock, haulage contractor. At night, when you cannot see the hideous shapes of the houses and the blackness of everything, a town like Sheffield assumes a kind of sinister magnificence. Sometimes the drifts of smoke are rosy with sulfur, and serrated flames, like circular saws, squeeze themselves out from beneath the cowls of the foundry chimneys. Through the open doors of foundries you see fiery serpents of iron being hauled to and fro by red-lit boys, and you hear the whiz and thump of steam hammers and the scream of the iron under the blow. The pottery towns are almost equally ugly in a pettier way. Right in among the rows of tiny blackened houses, part of the street as it were, are the pot banks, conical brick chimneys like gigantic burgundy bottles buried in the soil and belching their smoke almost in your face. You come upon monstrous clay chasms hundreds of feet across and almost as deep, with little rusty tubs creeping on chain railways up one side. And on the other workmen clinging like samphire gatherers and cutting into the face of the cliff with their picks. I passed that way in snowy weather, and even the snow was black. The best thing one can say for the pottery towns is that they are fairly small and stop abruptly. Less than 10 miles away you can stand in undefiled country, on the almost naked hills, and the pottery towns are only a smudge in the distance. When you contemplate such ugliness as this, there are two questions that strike you. First, is it inevitable? Secondly, does it matter? I do not believe that there is anything inherently and unavoidably ugly about industrialism. A factory or even a gasworks is not obliged of its own nature to be ugly, any more than a palace or a dog kennel or a cathedral. It all depends on the architectural tradition of the period. The industrial towns of the North are ugly because they happen to have been built at a time when modern methods of steel construction and smoke abatement were unknown, and when everyone was too busy making money to think about anything else. They go on being ugly largely because the Northerners have got used to that kind of thing and do not notice it. Many of the people in Sheffield or Manchester, if they smelled the air along the Cornish cliffs, would probably declare that it had no taste in it. But since the war, industry has tended to shift southward and in doing so has grown almost comely. The typical post-war factory is not a gaunt baroque or an awful chaos of blackness and belching chimneys, it is a glittering white structure of concrete, glass and steel, surrounded by green lawns and beds of tulips. Look at the factories you pass as you travel out of London on the GWR, they may not be aesthetic triumphs but certainly they are not ugly in the same way as the Sheffield gasworks. But in any case, though the ugliness of industrialism is the most obvious thing about it and the thing every newcomer exclaims against, I doubt whether it is centrally important. And perhaps it is not even desirable, industrialism being what it is, that it should learn to disguise itself as something else. As Mr. Aldous Huxley has truly remarked, a dark satanic mill ought to look like a dark satanic mill and not like the temple of mysterious and splendid gods. Moreover, even in the worst of the industrial towns one sees a great deal that is not ugly in the narrow aesthetic sense. A belching chimney or a stinking slum is repulsive chiefly because it implies warped lives and ailing children. Look at it from a purely aesthetic standpoint and it may have a certain macabre appeal. I find that anything outrageously strange generally ends by fascinating me even when I abominate it. The landscapes of Burma, which, when I was among them, so appalled me as to assume the qualities of nightmare, afterwards stayed so hauntingly in my mind that I was obliged to write a novel about them to get rid of them. In all novels about the East, the scenery is the real subject matter. It would probably be quite easy to extract a sort of beauty, as Arnold Bennett did, from the blackness of the industrial towns. One can easily imagine Baudelaire, for instance, writing a poem about a slag heap. But the beauty or ugliness of industrialism hardly matters. Its real evil lies far deeper and is quite ineradicable. It is important to remember this, because there is always a temptation to think that industrialism is harmless so long as it is clean and orderly. But when you go to the industrial north, you are conscious, quite apart from the unfamiliar scenery, of entering a strange country. This is partly because of certain real differences which do exist, but still more because of the north-south antithesis which has been rubbed into us for such a long time past. There exists in England a curious cult of northerness, a sort of northern snobbishness. A Yorkshireman in the south will always take care to let you know that he regards you as an inferior. If you ask him why, he will explain that it is only in the north that life is real life, that the industrial work done in the north is the only real work, that the North is inhabited by real people. The South merely by rentiers and their parasites. The Northerner has grit, he is grim, dour, plucky, warm-hearted and democratic, the Southerner is snobbish, effeminate and lazy, that at any rate is the theory. Hence the Southerner goes North, at any rate for the first time, with the vague inferiority complex of a civilized man venturing among savages, while the Yorkshireman, like the Scotchman, comes to London in the spirit of a barbarian out for loot. And feelings of this kind, which are the result of tradition, are not affected by visible facts. Just as an Englishman 5 feet 4 inches high and 29 inches round the chest feels that as an Englishman he is the physical superior of Carnera, Carnera being a Dago, so also with the Northerner and the Southerner. I remember a weedy little Yorkshireman who would almost certainly have run away if a fox terrier had snapped at him, telling me that in the south of England he felt like a wild invader. But the cult is often adopted by people who are not by birth Northerners themselves. A year or two ago a friend of mine, brought up in the south but now living in the north, was driving me through Suffolk in a car. We passed through a rather beautiful village. He glanced disapprovingly at the cottages and said, "Of course most of the villages in Yorkshire are hideous, but the Yorkshiremen are splendid chaps. Down here it's just the other way about, beautiful villages and rotten people. All the people in those cottages there are worthless, absolutely worthless." I could not help inquiring whether he happened to know anybody in that village. No, he did not know them, but because this was East Anglia they were obviously worthless. Another friend of mine, again a southerner by birth, loses no opportunity of praising the north to the detriment of the south. Here is an extract from one of his letters to me. "I am in Clitheroe, Lancs. I think running water is much more attractive in moorland mountain country than in the fat and sluggish south. The smug and silver Trent, Shakespeare says. And the souther the smugger, I say." Here you have an interesting example of the northern cult. Not only are you and I and everyone else in the south of England written off as fat and sluggish, but even water, when it gets north of a certain latitude, ceases to be H2O and becomes something mystically superior. But the interest of this passage is that its writer is an extremely intelligent man of advanced opinions who would have nothing but contempt for nationalism in its ordinary form. Put to him some such proposition as, "One Britisher is worth 3 foreigners," and he would repudiate it with horror. But when it is a question of North versus South, he is quite ready to generalize. All nationalistic distinctions, all claims to be better than somebody else because you have a different shaped skull or speak a different dialect, are entirely spurious, but they are important so long as people believe in them. There is no doubt about the Englishman's inbred conviction that those who live to the south of him are his inferiors. Even our foreign policy is governed by it to some extent. I think, therefore, that it is worth pointing out when and why it came into being. When nationalism first became a religion, the English looked at the map, and, noticing that their island lay very high in the northern hemisphere, evolved the pleasing theory that the further north you live the more virtuous you become. The histories I was given when I was a little boy generally started off by explaining in the naivest way that a cold climate made people energetic while a hot one made them lazy, and hence the defeat of the Spanish Armada. This nonsense about the superior energy of the English, actually the laziest people in Europe, has been current for at least 100 years. "Better is it for us," writes a Quarterly Reviewer of 1827, "to be condemned to labor for our country's good than to luxuriate amid olives, vines and vices." Olives, vines and vices sums up the normal English attitude towards the Latin races. In the mythology of Carlyle, Creasy, etc., the Northerner, Teutonic, later Nordic, is pictured as a hefty, vigorous chap with blonde mustaches and pure morals, while the Southerner is sly, cowardly and licentious. This theory was never pushed to its logical end, which would have meant assuming that the finest people in the world were the Eskimos, but it did involve admitting that the people who lived to the north of us were superior to ourselves. Hence, partly, the cult of Scotland and of Scotch things which has so deeply marked English life during the past 50 years. But it was the industrialization of the North that gave the North-South antithesis its peculiar slant. Until comparatively recently the northern part of England was the backward and feudal part, and such industry as existed was concentrated in London and the southeast. In the Civil War, for instance, roughly speaking a war of money versus feudalism, the North and West were for the King and the South and East for the Parliament. But with the increasing use of coal industry passed to the North, and there grew up a new type of man, the self-made northern businessman, the Mr. Rouncewell and Mr. Bounderby of Dickens. The northern businessman, with his hateful get-on-or-get-out philosophy, was the dominant figure of the 19th century, and as a sort of tyrannical corpse he rules us still. This is the type deified by Arnold Bennett, the type who starts off with half a crown and ends up with £50,000, and whose chief pride is to be an even greater boor after he has made his money than before. On analysis, his sole virtue turns out to be a talent for making money. We were bidden to admire him because though he might be narrow-minded, sordid, ignorant, grasping and uncouth, he had grit, he got on. In other words, he knew how to make money. This kind of cant is nowadays a pure anachronism, for the northern businessman is no longer prosperous. But traditions are not killed by facts, and the tradition of northern grit lingers. It is still dimly felt that a northerner will get on, i.e. make money, where a southerner will fail. At the back of the mind of every Yorkshireman and every Scotchman who comes to London is a sort of Dick Whittington picture of himself as the boy who starts off by selling newspapers and ends up as Lord Mayor. And that, really, is at the bottom of his bumptiousness. But where one can make a great mistake is in imagining that this feeling extends to the genuine working class. When I first went to Yorkshire, some years ago, I imagined that I was going to a country of boors. I was used to the London Yorkshireman with his interminable harangues and his pride in the supposed raciness of his dialect, a stitch in time saves nine, as we say in the West Riding, and I expected to meet with a good deal of rudeness. But I met with nothing of the kind, and least of all among the miners. Indeed, the Lancashire and Yorkshire miners treated me with a kindness and courtesy that were even embarrassing. For if there is one type of man to whom I do feel myself inferior, it is a coal miner. Certainly no one showed any sign of despising me for coming from a different part of the country. This has its importance when one remembers that the English regional snobberies are nationalism in miniature, for it suggests that place snobbery is not a working-class characteristic. There is nevertheless a real difference between North and South, and there is at least a tinge of truth in that picture of Southern England as one enormous Brighton inhabited by lounge lizards. For climatic reasons, the parasitic dividend-drawing class tend to settle in the South. In a Lancashire cotton town you could probably go for months on end without once hearing an educated accent, whereas there can hardly be a town in the South of England where you could throw a brick without hitting the niece of a bishop. Consequently, with no petty gentry to set the pace, the bourgeoisification of the working class, though it is taking place in the North, is taking place more slowly. All the northern accents, for instance, persist strongly, while the southern ones are collapsing before the movies and the BBC. Hence your educated accent stamps you rather as a foreigner than as a chunk of the petty gentry. And this is an immense advantage, for it makes it much easier to get into contact with the working class. But is it ever possible to be really intimate with the working class? I shall have to discuss that later. I will only say here that I do not think it is possible. But undoubtedly it is easier in the North than it would be in the South to meet working-class people on approximately equal terms. It is fairly easy to live in a miner's house and be accepted as one of the family, with, say, a farm laborer in the southern counties it probably would be impossible. I have seen just enough of the working class to avoid idealizing them, but I do know that you can learn a great deal in a working-class home, if only you can get there. The essential point is that your middle-class ideals and prejudices are tested by contact with others which are not necessarily better but are certainly different. Take for instance the different attitude towards the family. A working-class family hangs together as a middle-class one does, but the relationship is far less tyrannical. A working man has not that deadly weight of family prestige hanging round his neck like a millstone. I have pointed out earlier that a middle-class person goes utterly to pieces under the influence of poverty. And this is generally due to the behavior of his family, to the fact that he has scores of relations nagging and badgering him night and day for failing to get on. The fact that the working class know how to combine and the middle class don't is probably due to their different conceptions of family loyalty. You cannot have an effective trade union of middle-class workers, because in times of strikes almost every middle-class wife would be egging her husband on to blackleg and get the other fellow's job. Another working-class characteristic, disconcerting at first, is their plain-spokenness towards anyone they regard as an equal. If you offer a working man something he doesn't want, he tells you that he doesn't want it. A middle-class person would accept it to avoid giving offense. And again, take the working-class attitude towards education. How different it is from ours, and how immensely sounder. Working people often have a vague reverence for learning in others, but where education touches their own lives, they see through it and reject it by a healthy instinct. The time was when I used to lament over quite imaginary pictures of lads of 14 dragged protesting from their lessons and set to work at dismal jobs. It seemed to me dreadful that the doom of a job should descend upon anyone at 14. Of course, I know now that there is not one working-class boy in 1,000 who does not pine for the day when he will leave school. He wants to be doing real work, not wasting his time on ridiculous rubbish like history and geography. To the working class, the notion of staying at school till you are nearly grown up seems merely contemptible and unmanly. The idea of a great big boy of 18, who ought to be bringing a pound a week home to his parents, going to school in a ridiculous uniform and even being caned for not doing his lessons. Just fancy a working-class boy of 18 allowing himself to be caned. He is a man when the other is still a baby. Ernest Pontifex, in Samuel Butler's Way of All Flesh, after he had had a few glimpses of real life, looked back on his public school and university education and found it a sickly, debilitating debauch. There is much in middle-class life that looks sickly and debilitating when you see it from a working-class angle. In a working-class home, I am not thinking at the moment of the unemployed, but of comparatively prosperous homes, you breathe a warm, decent, deeply human atmosphere which it is not so easy to find elsewhere. I should say that a manual worker, if he is in steady work and drawing good wages, an if which gets bigger and bigger, has a better chance of being happy than an educated man. His home life seems to fall more naturally into a sane and comely shape. I have often been struck by the peculiar easy completeness, the perfect symmetry, as it were, of a working-class interior at its best. Especially on winter evenings after tea, when the fire glows in the open range and dances mirrored in the steel fender, when father, in shirt sleeves, sits in the rocking chair at one side of the fire reading the racing finals. And mother sits on the other with her sewing, and the children are happy with a pen north of mint humbugs, and the dog lolls roasting himself on the rag mat, it is a good place to be in. Provided that you can be not only in it but sufficiently of it to be taken for granted. This scene is still reduplicated in a majority of English homes, though not in so many as before the war. Its happiness depends mainly upon one question, whether father is in work. But notice that the picture I have called up, of a working-class family sitting round the coal fire after kippers and strong tea, belongs only to our own moment of time and could not belong either to the future or the past. Skip forward 200 years into the utopian future, and the scene is totally different. Hardly one of the things I have imagined will still be there. In that age when there is no manual labor and everyone is educated, it is hardly likely that father will still be a rough man with enlarged hands who likes to sit in shirt sleeves and says, "Ah, we're coom in Boop Street." And there won't be a coal fire in the grate, only some kind of invisible heater. The furniture will be made of rubber, glass and steel. If there are still such things as evening papers, there will certainly be no racing news in them, for gambling will be meaningless in a world where there is no poverty and the horse will have vanished from the face of the earth. Dogs, too, will have been suppressed on grounds of hygiene. And there won't be so many children, either, if the birth controllers have their way. But move backwards into the Middle Ages and you are in a world almost equally foreign. A windowless hut, a wood fire which smokes in your face because there is no chimney, moldy bread, poor John, lice, scurvy, a yearly childbirth and a yearly child death, and the priest terrifying you with tales of hell. Curiously enough, it is not the triumphs of modern engineering, or the radio, nor the cinematograph, nor the 5,000 novels which are published yearly, nor the crowds at Ascot and the Eton and Harrow match. But the memory of working-class interiors, especially as I sometimes saw them in my childhood before the war, when England was still prosperous, that reminds me that our age has not been altogether a bad one to live in. Photos: coal searchers South Wales, miners of the Fernhill Colliery come to the surface after a stay-in strike of nearly 2 weeks underground. Sylphinid, Pontypridd, South Wales, unemployed miners watching the buckets tipping slag in the hope that some coal may fall. 9 Mile Point Colliery, Newport, relatives and friends waiting at the pit head for news of the miners, who are conducting a stay-in strike below a row of undermined houses in Blenavon, Monmouthshire miners' cottages. A South Wales miner takes his bath outside Newcastle. Whole families of miners live in these tiny and insanitary dwellings, for which a rent of 7 shillings is charged. Miners' cottages at Coalbridge, miners' cottages at Blantyre. Blina, Wales, rotting interior of a slum dwelling house near Swansea threatened by slag heap. Blina, Wales, gap by a window of a school in Wales. Scullery in an offshoot coming away from the main building, now reconditioned. A basement in Limehouse, one of a whole street, note the parrot in a cage. Limehouse, Limehouse Scullery in Limehouse. Bethnal Green, Bethnal Green, Bethnal Green. Stepney, compare the new housing in the background. Stepney, Shadwell District. Stepney, Shadwell District. Stepney. Dinner on the table in Poplar Street. Pancras, before the slum clearance. Poplar, the basement is lived in. Poplar caravan dwellers near Durham Quarry. Overcrowding.